I don't know about you, but growing up, I watched a lot of The Simpsons. And there's an episode that lately I can't get out of my head. What happens is Bart releases a pair of invasive Bolivian tree lizards into the town of Springfield.
Well, I hope you're happy, Bart. You have no idea what kind of plague you've unleashed upon this town.
The local bird club is horrified at first, but then delighted when it turns out the lizard's preferred food is pigeon meat.
Pigeon, also known as the feathered rat. Well, I was wrong. The lizards are a godsend.
But isn't that a bit short-sighted? What happens when we're overrun by lizards?
No problem. We simply unleash wave after wave of Chinese needle snakes. They'll wipe out the lizards.
But aren't the snakes even worse?
Yes, but we're prepared for that. We've lined up a fabulous type of gorilla that thrives on snake meat.
But then we're stuck with gorillas!
No, that's the beautiful part. When wintertime rolls around, the gorillas simply freeze to death.
This idea, intentionally bringing in a species from somewhere else to combat another species accidentally introduced from somewhere else, using nature to fight nature, it has a name. It's called biocontrol. And you might have heard of some of the biocontrol horror stories that this Simpsons episode is kind of hinting at. Sugarcane farmers released mongooses in Hawaii, hoping they would kill the rats that were infesting their fields, but rats are nocturnal, and mongoose are not, and so instead they quickly started eating all of Hawaii's native rare birds. Another one you might have heard of? Cane toads! Cane toads were introduced into islands all over the place, again by sugarcane farmers, hoping they would eat cane beetles that were eating the sugarcane. But these toads are super poisonous. This biocontrol debacle wound up spawning a documentary that became kind of a cult classic, something high school stoners might watch just for fun.
I've had them attempt to mate with my foot. I've had them attempt to amplex with my hand. But most often, I've seen them trying to amplex with hunks of mud.
Again, the toads had almost no impact on the beetles they were trying to kill. Instead, they bred like crazy and are now killing off the northern quoll, an adorable little Australian rodent, along with some assorted Australian lizards. The cane toads were a total disaster.
He said this, and I quote, "We've got these bloody grubs by the balls this time, and we'll go on to bigger and brighter things." But tragically, we didn't have the grubs by the balls. They had us by the balls.
And yet, despite all these failures, we are still doing this. What gives? This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it, or how we try to, anyway. All over the world, wherever there are invasive species, there are people trying to figure out what bug or bacteria or virus they can introduce that will beat back the invasion. Biocontrol feels like the pinnacle of human arrogance. We're trying to play God. We're taking a delicately balanced ecosystem and stomping all over it with all the precision of a wrecking ball. But what if playing God is our best option? What if it's our only option? Should we do it? The first thing you should understand here is that biocontrol started out as the environmentally friendly alternative to pesticides. Pesticides have all sorts of downsides. They kill lots of insects, not just the ones you're trying to get rid of. They're dangerous for the workers applying them and for anyone else nearby. And so this idea of just letting loose a couple of good critters to eat the bad ones, it felt like a really clever idea. But the scientists who were working on this, back before the world wars and going all the way up through the 70s, they were a little cocky.
Biocontrol practitioners were overly confident.
That's Russell Messing from the Kauai Agricultural Research Station in Hawaii. Hawaii is kind of ground zero for biocontrol. Some of the biggest successes and failures happened there.
They thought biocontrol agents were, you know, impossible to do any harm. They were all positive. There was no risk.
Let me just read you some quotes from papers about biocontrol written during this time.
In the past, it has been made abundantly clear that research in this sphere results in prodigious economic benefits without any environmental hazards.
Here's another.
No adverse effects on the ecosystem occur from biological control.
This, clearly, was hubris, overconfidence. And to tell the story of this hubris, I'm going to tell you about moths here in New England. These moths are called giant silkworms.
So this guy's probably about 2 inches long, maybe, you know, and he's bulky, like it's a large caterpillar.
Yeah, we call them juicy.
To see some of these, I visited a place called the Caterpillar Lab in Keene, New Hampshire. This is one of the lab's founders, Sam Jaffe.
You know, they're porkers. So Lunas are sort of the classic big squishy green caterpillar.
These moths are objectively beautiful. And for my money, the prettiest of the bunch is the Luna moth. It's pale green and about the size of your hand, and it has these long, exquisite tails that delicately fall away from their wings. This is the kind of moth people would write poems about. But there are lots of others. There's North America's biggest moth, the Cecropia, which has this rust-colored body and soft gray wings banded with thin ribbons of white, red, and black. Then there's the hickory-horned devil, which, as a caterpillar, can be the size of a hot dog.
These are our charismatic mini-fauna. You go out and you're walking down a trail and you see a hickory-horned devil or a Cecropia, that's going to stick with you. Everybody who sees a Luna moth, that's a story that they tell us at a program that's touched their lives. So we feel like these large caterpillars in general, have a lot of power to engage people with the world around them.
They're all pretty much harmless. Big, pretty, and non-threatening. And Joe Elkington, a moth expert at UMass Amherst, says here in New England, they used to be all over the place.
If you read the accounts from the 19th century, people might have dozens of cocoons in their backyard.
This makes New England almost sound like a tropical paradise. Beautiful moths the size of your hand just dripping from the trees. Caterpillars the size of hot dogs peacefully munching on leaves.
The moths haven't gone extinct. They're still out there, but they're very hard to find now. And that's a shame.
So what happened? How did we lose our giant caterpillar wonderland? The answer has to do with another moth, an invasive one from Europe, the gypsy moth.
We know how it got here. It was a professor at Harvard named Leopold Trouvelot who was doing some half-baked experiments with gypsy moth back in 1868, and they escaped out his bedroom window.
Gypsy moths aren't big. They're maybe an inch long. They're camouflaged to blend in with tree bark, so they're pretty drab. And gypsy moths here in the U.S., they're like a living natural disaster, a plague.
The biggest outbreak in history was in 1981. In that year, almost the entire state of Massachusetts, and indeed all of New England, was defoliated.
Defoliated, as in gypsy moths ate all of the leaves off the trees.
I mean, take me back to that time. If we were to look out from your window right now, what would it look like?
You'd just see brown trees that it looked like wintertime.
So back when they were first invading in the early 1900s, Bostonians saw the damage these caterpillars were causing and tried to get them under control. This is Jesse Varga, another guy from the Caterpillar Lab.
The methods they were using, collecting eggs off of trees, burning trees that they were in, weren't slowing the spread of them.
So what do you do? What they did was try this newfangled strategy, biocontrol. If the gypsy moth is from Europe, let's go to Europe and bring back what eats it there. That's where they found this parasite.
Compsellura concinnata.
Compsellura concinnata. It's a fly. It just looks like any old fly, but it lays its eggs inside other insects, which kills the host.
1906, the first introduction of Compsellura happened.
Do you know if this was on purpose?
It was. It was done by the Department of Agriculture, I believe.
And this fly, Compsellura, it did attack gypsy moths, but not very many of them. And it attacked a lot of other things, too.
Right now, there's over 200 recorded native species, so it could be more. We're not sure.
Compsellura was basically like a sledgehammer. Sure, it hit some gypsy moths, but it was pretty imprecise. And some of the hardest hit native species? New England's biggest, craziest, most beautiful moths and caterpillars, like the Luna moth, and that caterpillar that's the size of a hot dog.
We did a study where we put out caterpillars and we documented the mortality, and Comps lura was by far and away the biggest source of mortality. It killed about 85% of the larvae in the first few instars.
You must be thinking, man, introducing species like this is just a terrible idea. Why do we do it? Why?
In the absence of biocontrol, there is no solution. I mean, there's no solution.
With pests like this that spread virulently, exponentially, totally out of control, what can you do? You could try picking them all off the trees by hand, a more or less impossible and stupidly expensive option. You can try spraying pesticides everywhere, but that also kills native caterpillars and costs a lot of money. Or you can do nothing. Let nature sort itself out. In which case, you might have to sacrifice virtually all of the plants that the pest you're trying to kill is attacking. And depending on what's being attacked, doing nothing could be disastrous. Just as an example, and there are dozens of examples like this, there's this bug eating its way through hemlock trees in New England. There are 90 species of native birds that use hemlocks for eating or nesting. Three bird species can't live in anything other than hemlocks. And the shade these trees throws on streams cools them off, making it possible for brook trout, a favorite of fishermen, to survive.
Loss of hemlock is a tragedy.
So if you give up on biocontrol, you're making life really hard for hemlock, brook trout, the black-throated green warbler, solitary vireo, the northern goshawk, Acadian flycatchers, Blackburnian warblers, Canada warblers, or Canada warblers. Our first attempt at controlling the gypsy moths failed miserably. For decades after the release of Comps lura, as giant silkworm moth populations declined, gypsy moths continued to wreak havoc on New England forests. And the eventual solution to this problem? Well, it was biocontrol. Take two. This is Anne Hayek. She's a Cornell professor. Back in the 80s, Anne was still working on trying to control gypsy moths, decades after that crazy Harvard professor accidentally set them loose. She was using a fungus.
So can you tell me what it was like when you first walked into a forest that had been infected with this fungus?
Oh, it was very exciting indeed. And there are just dead gypsy moths, caterpillars all over the tree trunks.
It basically appeared overnight. We walked out into our research plots out of the Quabbin Reservoir. There were dead caterpillars hanging everywhere.
Truth is, it wasn't actually Anne who released the fungus into the wild. She tried to, but it didn't survive. They never found out where this release came from. But over the course of a few years, this hyper-focused, scalpel-like fungus spread and spread. After a little while, the gypsy moth, this ravenous consumer of New England's hardwoods...
The pest isn't a pest anymore.
The only time you hear about gypsy moths now is in very, very dry years. Conditions that make it hard for the fungus to grow. Like this year, which is how I learned about this whole story. So within this one story of the gypsy moth caterpillar, we've got both the best and the worst examples of this thing called biocontrol. You've got Comps lura, the fly, the sledgehammer, which almost entirely missed its target and has this voracious appetite for some of our most lovely moths and butterflies.
To lose such a crazy, wonderful, colorful, large group of creatures, it's a real loss. I think a significant, maybe devastating loss.
But then you've got this fungus, the scalpel, which very specifically goes after just the gypsy moths, an awful plague introduced from Europe.
It's the example of a perfect biocontrol project.
Before starting to work on this episode, I had heard about the horror stories. They are definitely the dominant narrative in our culture. Cane toads in Australia, the mongooses in Hawaii. But I hadn't heard about all the success stories. For instance, when California's citrus industry was just getting off the ground, a pest called cottony cushion scale hit. But a ladybug that only eats cottony cushion scale was introduced, and it literally saved the entire industry. Another example, in the 70s, parts of Central Africa started to see massive crop failures of cassava, a plant that feeds hundreds of millions of people all over the world. The culprit was an insect from South America called the cassava mealybug. To combat it, scientists introduced a tiny parasitic wasp, which laid its eggs in the mealybug, and again, very specifically, just in that mealybug. In a few years, crop damage from the bugs fell by 90%, and it's estimated that every dollar invested in the wasp program saved farmers between $200 and $500 worth of ruined cassava. So why haven't we heard these success stories? Back in the 80s, this guy named Frank Howarth wrote a paper called Classical Biocontrol, Panacea or Pandora's Box. Howarth collected in one place a bunch of the biocontrol horror stories. It kicked off a whole backlash against biocontrol. There was that documentary about the cane toads, and suddenly everyone outside of the scientific world who had never heard of biocontrol before was hearing about how awful it was.
Because it's kind of like the man bites dog story. Biocontrol was always considered wonderful, and then here's people saying, oh, but it's harming our native ecosystems. It's doing harm. And it just became one of these fads in ecology.
That's Russell Messing again, the scientist from Hawaii. People doing biocontrol have responded to these critiques. Back more than 100 years ago, when scientists and farmers were doing it, they were doing it sort of willy-nilly. In fact, a lot of times, they liked when the bugs they introduced ate lots of native species because they figured they'd be more likely to survive if that was the case. But today, if you want to introduce a parasitic wasp or fly, you have to do way more testing. You have to try to prove that the bug in question only attacks the pest you're targeting.
It can take years. I had one project that took more than 6 years. I'm still working on the project.
So, how dangerous is biocontrol? How many horror stories are there? Here are the numbers that I could find. I have two studies. One looked at insects released to control other insects, and they found that out of more than 7,000 releases over the entire history of biocontrol, only 12 times have there been major impacts on non-targeted species. Another, looking at insects released in order to eat exotic weeds, again, found that better than 99% had no significant impacts on the wrong plants. Those numbers even include the big mistakes that scientists made a century ago. But I don't think that most people have heard about that.
But isn't that a bit short-sighted? What happens when we're overrun by lizards?
Because when biocontrol works, it's invisible. It looks just like the natural world. Predators and prey in balance.
Those dangerous introductions aren't being done anymore, and this is kind of an old-fashioned view, actually.
But there are skeptics, even among the scientists. I talked to one of them, Dan Simberloff from the University of Tennessee. I asked him about those two studies. And so what you're saying is that probably that's underestimating.
No, I'm saying more than that. I'm saying it's definitely underestimating.
Dan's point is there simply isn't anyone going out to check after every one of these releases to see what's happening. What are those bugs eating? Are they eating some incredibly rare bug, the kind of bug that might make an entomologist's heart beat faster whenever they see it? For instance, Dan points out that right now there's an invasive wood-boring beetle that is currently eating ash trees from Michigan to New England. The wasps that are being introduced to combat that beetle had to be tested to ensure they wouldn't attack native beetles. But here in the U.S., there are 150 kinds of wood-boring beetle. How can you possibly test to make sure that your new species that you want to introduce doesn't eat any single one of those?
Some of them are so rare that, you know, they're only collected by entomologists once every decade, if that. Then what's the next question you should ask?
Well, did they test all of those?
Right. How many do you think they tested?
A dozen.
At most. I doubt if they tested a dozen. Then, of course, they would not test the rare ones because they can't find them.
Now, Dan says he is not opposed to biocontrol.
But I think think it should be a last resort because of the fact that it's usually irreversible.
But his threshold for when it should be used is a lot higher. In fact, he's willing to let whole species of common plants be largely wiped out because he says eventually the ones that survive will slowly, over the course of centuries, repopulate with individuals that are resistant to pests. That, he argues, is a better solution because you're not risking driving some of these rare insects, the ones that we can't possibly test for, into extinction. I mean, because that, as a solution, doesn't really happen on a human time scale, do you think that that's a palatable solution to propose to people?
I think it should be, but whether it is palatable, no. You know, where people generally want immediate gratification.
If you think you know where you stand on this debate, I have just one more story. Remember the gypsy moth and the fly that was introduced, which went totally off the rails and became a scourge on the beautiful Luna moth? That fly was a total failure as a biocontrol agent, and everyone I interviewed agrees it was a bad idea. But it does seem to have one upside.
So brown-tailed moth is an insect that most of your listeners have probably never heard of.
Brown-tailed moth was another invasive species from Europe. But unlike gypsy moths, they're covered with these nasty hairs which blow around in the wind.
So it causes severe allergic reaction in many people.
For places that have brown-tailed moths, the recommendation is to wear a respirator, goggles, and coveralls tightly closed at the neck, wrists, and ankles whenever you're outside doing things like mowing the lawn for the entire summer. Sounds awful. There's even a documented case of someone dying from the reaction. It was a serious problem in the early 20th century, but today it's virtually gone. So what happened? Compsellura concinnata, that same fly that killed nearly all of our pretty moths.
The timing was perfect. We wrote a paper. We were convinced that Compsellura concinnata was responsible for the decline of brown-tailed moth.
It's a complicated world out there. So the real question is, knowing that we can never be 100% certain, what do you think we should do? And Outside In continues. After the break, we're going to do our part to control invasive species by eating them. Grab yourself a fork and a knife. Outside In will be right back. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. So before the break, we talked about the fight to control gypsy moths in New England. But invasive species wreak havoc all across the world, and people have tried a number of ways to get rid of them. So we figured we'd do our part.
No other species can defeat them.
They're invasive.
So why don't we just freaking eat them?
Because we're hungry.
Eat the invaders.
This is Eat the Invaders, our occasional segment where we take a bite out of invasive species populations. On the menu today, one of the scariest, most voracious, and intractable invasions out there, the lionfish.
They're also called the zebrafish or the turkeyfish or the devilfish. It's like a fish wearing a costume.
That's Rachel Bowman, who lives down in the Florida Keys.
And I am a commercial spearer of lionfish.
That must really kill at dinner parties when you introduce yourself that way. To get a sense of what the lionfish looks like, picture a tropical fish crossed with a peacock, crossed with a zebra, crossed with a set of Scottish bagpipes. You should probably just Google this. They're from the Indo-Pacific region, but now they're everywhere in the Caribbean, and increasingly they're spreading up the East Coast, and they're an ecological disaster. Luckily, they have one weakness that we humans love to exploit.
Oh, lionfish are delicious.
You just add butter and white wine to things.
They get tastier.
How can you go wrong? Oh, and maybe some salt.
But before we butter them up, let's first address what makes lionfish so problematic. One factor? Their voracious appetites.
They're not picky. They are not picky, man. They eat anything, and they eat all of it, and then they come back for more.
Lionfish feed on small reef fish that are a huge part of the ocean food chain. One study in the Bahamas found that in just 2 years after their arrival, there was a 65% decline in the quantity of local fish.
They're a gape-limited predator, which means they can eat pretty much anything that can fit in its mouth. They have a method of feeding that's called suction feeding. So a lionfish, when it sees something that it wants to eat, its jaw actually protrudes out and away from its body. When it does that, it creates a suction of water into the mouth. So the lionfish basically turns into the Death Star, and it has this tractor beam. That's how bad it is.
The other big factor is that, like many invasives, lionfish are prolific breeders. One female can lay 30 million eggs in a single year. Put these two things together, voracious appetite and the ability to multiply exponentially, and you've got yourselves a spiny, bagpipey marine disaster. So how did lionfish wind up on our dinner plates? Well, producer Logan Shannon just ordered them from a distributor, Norman's Lionfish, and they shipped it right to NHPR's studio in Concord, New Hampshire.
And how much did it cost?
$60.
So this is $30 worth of fish.
Yeah.
That's
The shipping was free.
But how did the lionfish get from its native turf in the Indo-Pacific all the way to the Atlantic coast? That is a weirder story. The somewhat mythical origin story is that the lionfish invasion began in 1992 when Hurricane Andrew rolled through Florida and smashed up an aquarium in Biscayne Bay. This story persists even though the fish was actually first seen off the coast of Miami years before, and the biologist who suggested that theory has since discounted it. It's much more likely that the lionfish invasion started in people's homes. Lionfish, when you see them in the pet store, look pretty behind the glass. But when you take them home and they eat all of the other fish in your aquarium, you get the idea. Probably this invasion got its start from many people releasing a fish or two here and a fish or two there for years. And not to moralize, but hey, Florida. This is a pretty similar story to how you got your problem with pythons, anacondas, tegu lizards, and monitor lizards. Maybe Florida, keeping exotic pets just isn't for you. Anyway, just imagine if these people had made a couple of fish tacos instead of dumping their once and former pets into the Gulf of Mexico. Another thing that you should know about lionfish is that it takes a lot of effort to catch them. Lionfish hang out near coral reefs, which nets have this unfortunate tendency of getting tangled in. They're also really hard to hook on a line, and traps tend to catch lots of other fish species, not just lionfish. So to catch them, people like Rachel Bowman have to dive underwater and spear them one by one. Oh, and did I mention that those bagpipey spines that cover the lionfish? Yeah, they're venomous. So what does that feel like when you get stung?
Oh, man. I don't have kids, but a friend of mine who has a son has told me that it's right up there with childbirth. It feels like your bones are expanding from the inside out.
Good Lord, that sounds awful. How many times have you been stung like that, like a real sting?
A bad sting, I've probably had about 10 bad stings.
Jeez. So, you know, 10 times you've gone through that just for the love of going down there to spear these fish. Is it worth it?
I go the next day. I mean, getting stung ends my diving for the day, but I'm back on the boat the next morning.
Wow.
Absolutely.
A lot of invasive species aren't really palatable enough to make eating them a reasonable defense strategy. But stings or no stings, there's a growing market for speared lionfish. Whole Foods has begun to sell lionfish in its stores in Florida, and spearfishers can make around $6 a pound selling whole, ungutted fish to the supermarket. Speaking of ungutted, the lionfish was delivered to us whole, scales, fins, heads with creepy, unblinking eyeballs, and all. Venomous tips were clipped off, for the record.
Step one, lay the fish on its side and cut all the way down its back, just to one side of the top fin. I can't even read it.
A little admission here, I'm not much of a fisherman, so we read about how to fillet and watched a video.
Did you get that bird out of your video, dude?
This is like science class.
So then I think you release the fillet from the back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come down.
But I think you should pull the skin off. Yeah.
Woo! A fillet.
I've got to say, apart from the whole adventure of filleting a fish for the first time, this was a pretty conventional fish cooking experience. Take fish, add ingredients, cook.
I'm gonna put some shallots in there because I already cut those up. I'm gonna put some lemon zest. And I'm going to just do a little white wine.
Hey, Jared.
Yep.
And just a short time later, the lionfish was ready.
Are you ready to try it?
Sure. Yeah. All right.
It's real hot.
The verdict?
Yeah, it tastes like fish.
Tastes like fish.
Yeah.
But you can taste the lemon. Yeah, you can.
Mostly tastes like fish with lemon on it.
So will eating lionfish really put a dent in their population? Well, let's imagine lionfish suddenly took off as a cuisine and spearfishing became big business. Even then, major hurdles remain. Yes, if you fish the same reef over and over, it'll be harder to find lionfish. But all it takes is a spell of bad weather to keep the spear fishermen out of the water, and then the population seems to bounce right back. But all hope is not lost.
I have lobster fishermen that set traps in the areas where I've been harvesting lionfish for the past 4 years. And those commercial fishermen have told me they see less lionfish in their traps in those areas. And those people that, you know, sit there and say, well, you're not going to be able to make a difference. No, no one has ever made a difference by sitting there and saying that, have they? I'm doing something.
And Outside In remains on the high seas. Next up, we're going to leave the GPS at home and climb aboard a Polynesian sailing canoe to try to awaken our inner sense of direction. What happens when you set out for a 2,000-mile voyage across the ocean without a map or a compass? We'll find out after the break. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Pop quiz. Which way are we going? North, south, east, or west?
Oh, geez.
A couple of weeks ago, my wife Aubrey and I took a trip out west. We were hiking.
Are you recording me?
I don't know.
Yes, you are.
Both of us are New Englanders and have spent very little time in Western landscapes. And to make things worse, on this day, we were totally socked in. It was snowing and cloudy, and you couldn't see the sun.
South is that way.
That way? What makes you say that?
Because I looked at the map.
Okay, so I don't normally ambush Aubrey mid-hike, but I have been thinking about navigating. How did people used to know their way before maps and compasses?
Well, point around. Give me some evidence.
Well, there's a lot of snow here. Which means it might be the north side of a mountain. Which means that south would be that way.
This is a good thought. Except that only works when the sun has been out for long enough to melt the snow a little bit on south-facing slopes. And right then, the snow was still falling. So,
which way does the wind blow from?
Another good idea. Except,
I don't know. This is my first day here. Which way was the wind blowing earlier?
The trees. It looks to me like this wind always blows from that way.
So how would you normally figure it out?
The sunshine.
Mm. No sun.
No.
So what do we do?
Look at the map.
So, I want you to take a step back to imagine a world without a web of GPS satellites telling your smartphone where you are every second of the day. Imagine a world before maps, before compasses, a world which, really, in the grand scheme of human evolution, is where we've been for most of the history of our species. This might sound like a dangerous, maybe like a scary place, one where you could get lost and never be seen again, but it's also a world where maybe you'll discover you had a hidden superpower, one that's been inside you all along if you just knew how to turn it on. To help us do that, let's turn to the superstars of navigation, the Polynesians.
About 7,000 years ago, out of Southeast Asia, you know, there are people that developed this technology of building a craft that could go over the horizon, you know, into the deeper ocean. And they also developed a system of navigation, you know, to keep track of their travels and to come back home.
The islands in the Pacific Ocean were some of the last places on the planet to be settled by humans. And that's because they were just tiny little specks of land in the largest ocean in the world and incredibly hard to find. But the Polynesians did it.
You know, we speak about Polynesia, but really these peoples went all the way across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar, through Indonesia, all the way across the Pacific to the west coast of both of North and South America.
This is Bruce Blankenfeld with the Polynesian Voyaging Society. He's one of a few dozen master navigators, people from the islands in the Pacific who know how to find their way without maps and compasses. Over the course of a few thousand years, the Polynesians used sailing canoes to spread to basically every speck of land in the Pacific Ocean.
Oh my gosh. It was like, you know, I mean, anytime you go into the unknown, when you have no idea what you'll be facing, I mean, that takes, I mean, tremendous risk and tremendous courage just to keep taking those steps.
And based on Hawaiian oral history, these were some serious adventurers.
One of the first navigators that found Hawaii, his name was Hawaii Loa, he was out, they say, on an extended fishing trip, which is like very extended fishing trip. And he was away from home for about 3 months. I mean, three cycles of the moon. And he located the islands and he sailed through them and then he went back home and then the migration started after that.
Hawaii was one of the last islands to be settled by the Polynesians. And for generations, the sailing canoes continued back and forth between Hawaii and the other Polynesian islands. That's a voyage of more than 2,000 miles. But then, for some reason, the voyaging stopped for 600 years. And the skills that these sailors had, the ones that guided them across miles and miles of ocean, they started to atrophy. But then in the 1970s, a hodgepodge of Hawaiian anthropologists and adventurers got this crazy idea to build a replica of a traditional sailing canoe as a way of proving that their ancestors were the expert navigators their stories portrayed. Now, if you're picturing a canoe like what you would rent at the local boat launch, this is not what a voyaging canoe looks like. It's really two canoes, each of them 60 feet long with a deck in between them. So it's more like a catamaran, longer than a coach bus, 20 feet wide, and with space for about 8 people to sleep head to toe down in the hulls of the boat. They called it the Hokulea.
But the key to it all was having someone who had the knowledge and the skill to navigate. They did find somebody to do that, and that was what made all the difference.
On the tiny atoll of Satawal, a place that European colonization had largely skipped over and where local traditions were still intact, the Hawaiians met a man named Mau Piailug, a master navigator who had been taught by his own grandfather. They convinced him to come to Hawaii, hoping he could sail their new canoe from Hawaii to Tahiti. And in 1976, they embarked on their first voyage, with Mau at the helm.
So, you know, it's really funny, from Mau's perspective, I believe, is you're not going from like point A to point B. You're like stationary and you are pulling the islands towards you. When you first see that first tip of the islands or whatever, I mean, that's what's happening. It's coming out of the sea, out of the horizon.
The distance between these two island chains is around 2,500 miles. Sailing there directly, when you know exactly where to go, takes around 30 days. The entire archipelago that contains Tahiti is only 450 miles long, so that's basically the target the sailors are trying to hit. I feel like for the first people to make this voyage, it must have been like standing at the edge of a vast desert, not knowing what was on the other side or how big that desert was, and thinking, okay, let's do this. So how does this work? How do you find your way using nothing but your wits and the natural world? Let's ask some people who are learning right now. Kaiulani Murphy is an apprentice navigator on the Hokulea, which is still on the water today.
Yeah, basically we use any clues in nature that we can to help us find direction and then know when we are getting closer to land.
The first tools in her navigating toolbox are, kind of obviously, the sun and the stars. Kaleo Wong, another apprentice, says they're the most consistent and predictable guide.
Well, there's a list of like 200 stars that Nainoa and our teachers use. We probably use really maybe 100 or so. Know exactly where they rise, how they move across the sky, and where they set.
But there's a problem with relying on the sun and the stars, which is, what about cloudy days? What happens when you can't see the stars?
But then there's the swells, which is the most important to know because you're going to always see the ocean surface. You're not always going to see the stars.
So for me, this part is kind of mind-blowing. Out on the ocean, they navigate using the waves. Navigators are up at dawn every day, observing. They take mental notes. Where's the wind coming from? Where are the clouds? What do they look like? And then they feel the swells. How are they moving in relation to the course of the ship? How does that make the ship feel beneath your feet? They lock onto that feeling. They try to memorize it. That feeling is their heading. And when it's cloudy, or when the sun is straight up overhead, they navigate by that feeling.
So that's why sunrise and sunset, super important times of every day, because you have a reference point, and so you know the direction the swells are coming from based on where that sun is rising. Yeah, and then we keep our course with those swells throughout the day.
For Mao Piailu, who had learned the art of navigation starting as a child, this wasn't something he could just turn off. Bruce says during that voyage back in 1976, the first time the Hawaiians had sailed to Tahiti, they were amazed to see that Mao hardly slept. But when he did,
Mao was so in tune that yes, when he did go below, when he, you know, needed some rest, even while he was just exhausted and probably sleeping, you know, he could feel the difference and know that they weren't, they were off course.
Now, think of your GPS. It isn't just great because it gives you directions, but because it tells you exactly where you are. But on a sailing canoe, there is no blue dot. They've just got the stars.
One of the stars that we use is the North Star. It's directly relational to where you are on this Earth. So if you're at the North Pole, the North Star is straight overhead. And if you're on the equator, the North Star is right on the horizon. We just put our hand out in the sky, and sometimes it's a finger or two or three or four or whatever it takes to measure the stars based off of where we are.
That's going to be different depending on whose hand, though. Like, your hand's got to be...
Much smaller, yes. We calibrate our hands individually. So we do know what the measurements are on our hands before we go and measure the stars.
So do you know how many degrees you can reach?
I'm like 19 degrees, which is not... I can't measure Hokupa, the North Star, in Hawaii completely. But, yeah.
These navigators stand out on the ocean, holding their hands up to the night sky over and over, night after night. They do it so many times that they know exactly how high off the horizon certain stars should be when they hit the latitude they're aiming for. They know exactly what the sky should look like when they reach home. So, back in 1976, when the Hokuleo was making its maiden voyage from Hawaii to Tahiti with the navigator Mau Pialuk at the helm, this is what he was looking for. As they sailed south with no blue dot telling them how far along they were, every night he would look up into the sky and the Southern Cross would get higher above the horizon, looking more and more like the sky of his home. Now here's something to think about. People who have the skills of someone like Mau Pialuk aren't just using some pre-GPS star chart version of GPS. They actually have a totally different way of seeing the world. Just think about how you get from point to point. As you go, chances are you've got what's called an egocentric orientation. When I get to that brick building on the left, I turn right. Your directions are based on looking for landmarks, signs, and figuring out where they are in space in relation to you.
Everybody knows about the stone cairns, you know, the piles of rocks. Sticks were used, blazes mocking trees, even a simple bending of a branch. We know some groups pile up sticks and put them in a direction to say how many people were in their party, which direction they were going upstream or downstream. All these things were little indicators.
This is Paul Puglio, Sagamaw or speaker of the Kawasuk, a band of Abenaki who live here in New England and up into Quebec. And here is where Paul's ancestors were different from us. They didn't necessarily have that egocentric orientation. He says they oriented themselves based on where their bodies were in relation to the planet. And he says that navigation is embedded into their language.
We followed the sun. We had the same cardinal points, but we were either traveling into the sun, away from the sun, or into the sunset. And we knew things by those directions. So when we said into the sun, we went Waji Songkut Posit, into the sun. If we're going away from the sun, is Ali Nahilo, which is away from the sun. If we're going north, it was Babanki. And if we're going south, it was Sewanaki.
This might seem like kind of an obvious point. I mean, if you go far enough back into the history of the words east and west, they're describing sunrise and sunset too. But there is an important idea embedded here. As we've developed more and more technology, a subtle shift has happened. For example, when I say, look east.
Look east.
What happens in your brain?
Take the exit.
Chances are you picture a map. And from there, you extrapolate which way must be east in relation to where you're facing.
Over there.
Now, imagine what it would be like if you had never seen a map.
Recalculating.
When I say east, that would mean look toward the dawn.
Recalculating.
The only way you would know where east is by having actually seen the sun come up over the horizon. There are actually whole languages that don't have words like left and right. Instead, if they're going to warn you of some sort of danger, they might say, hey, watch out for that snake to the north of your foot. And you would just know where that snake was because you just knew. Because you've been paying attention for your whole life to which way was which. You'd never get disoriented.
As you start to develop the skills, you gain this own kind of consciousness that you didn't realize you had the capabilities of getting.
John Huth is a Harvard professor, a teacher of particle physics. Like most of us, he grew up with maps and compasses left and right. But he got a scare. He was in a kayak in the Gulf of Maine in open water when a fog bank rolled in, and suddenly he couldn't see anything. He managed to make his way to shore, but the next day he saw on the news that two other paddlers caught in that same fog got lost and died. So he decided to learn how to navigate.
At night, I can just look up in the sky, and without having to name the names of stars or even think about it, I can just find my way. Over time, with practice, the thinking one thing, then another, and another by conscious choice starts to fall away, and you start to do it unconsciously.
That's kind of, doesn't that sort of strikes me as almost like a superpower. It's like we all had this superpower that we've given up on.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a little surprising because it's like somebody, I don't know, turned on a light bulb. There's all this stuff in front of you that you were not paying attention to. It's hard to describe it.
Superpower is the wrong word here. What this is a sense. It's a sense of direction. It's different. A sense is something we all have, or at least have the potential to have, if we were paying attention, if we knew what to look for. Do you feel like you ever reach that point where you kind of, you don't have to look and think to know what direction you're faced?
Yeah, most times, probably 99% of the time, yeah. You know, because, you know, I mean, the navigation is based on your natural world. So it's like where the sun rises, where the sun sets, you know, where the stars rise and where they set, you know. And then the stars, I just remember looking at the sky as a youngster, and all you just see is like billions of dots of light up there. But now you're looking at a definite map. So, yes, you know, I mean, I kind of see it like that, sure.
Back in 1976, after 31 days at sea without maps or a compass, Mao Piailug successfully led the Hokulea more than 2,500 miles from Hawaii to Tahiti. It was a madhouse. Around 17,000 Tahitians, nearly 10% of the entire country's population, came out to greet the canoe when it arrived. This is one of the original crew members in a documentary called Papa Mao, The Wayfinder.
Couldn't keep people up. And you know, the people on board were like the mayor, the governor, and his wife, and all their family come first. You know, it's like all the kids. We couldn't keep the kids off. And everybody's dancing, and you know, you couldn't stop it.
In the years after, Hokulea took more trips all over Polynesia, and then longer trips, eventually crossing the entire Pacific Ocean. And each of these voyages taught new crew members how to navigate using only the stars and the swells, the feeling of the ocean. More importantly, it gave these new sailors the confidence to know they could find their way. Mao passed away in 2010, but the Hokulea is still voyaging today. The expert navigators on board are still tackling long, unpredictable crossings. For instance, last winter they set off from Namibia and sailed west towards St. Helena, the tiny, isolated island where Napoleon was exiled. Along the way, they found themselves shrouded in a thick fog for 3 days. When that fog lifted, they discovered they were off course, so they started sailing north, only to see a huge thunderstorm in the distance. Kaleo Wong, an apprentice on the Hokulea, was supposed to be in charge, but Bruce Blankenfeld was there to back him up.
And we both kind of looked at each other. He goes, "I think it's time to tack." I said, "I think so." So we tacked, and just hours later, we're going straight at the island. There it is. It was like the most amazing sight.
And I remember when we finally got to the island, I asked them, like, you know, is there always that doubt? He's telling me that it's always there. You just got to learn to put that aside and don't think about that and believe in the teachings of your ancestors and trust yourself, and the island will be there. And for me, that's what it was like.
This is not some kind of mystical skill that you need to be trained from birth by your grandfather to learn, although that can't hurt. Anyone can learn to get their bearings, You just need to pay attention when you're out in the world. Look around yourself. Where are the sun and the stars? What way is the wind blowing? How do the trees grow?
Okay, Aubrey. Pop quiz. Which way are we going?
This past weekend, I tried again. This time while mountain biking with a friend named Sarah.
Oh, jeez. Well, let's see. I think we're going east.
I think we're going north, but I have no idea. Sarah, do you know what way we're going?
I think we're going southwest.
Oh, man.
For the record, we were going almost due west. I guess we're going to have to pay a little more attention if we want to get our sixth sense back. Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Our theme is by Breakmaster Cylinder. You can find our lionfish recipes as well as photos and videos of how we cooked it at outsideinradio.org.
I mean, I wish it were easier to catch it, because why not take this thing over and just eat it all?
Yeah.
Don't forget to subscribe to Outside In on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.